It is now my privilege to introduce our main speaker, who comes to us from the Going to Any Lengths group located in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Please welcome Dave B.
Hi, everybody. My name is David Bray, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
And I have a sobriety date of January 2nd, 1981. And for that period of time, I'm extremely grateful. And I want to thank Danny for inviting me to participate in your meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The one thing that I have been taught, but more than that, now I have come to believe that it is a privilege to participate in AA, that I don't have some right to what goes on here. I have not done anything that allows me the ability to take and to receive the power that is in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that it was there when I first got here. It just seemed like a room full of goofy people. Sometimes I'd go to a meeting and people would laugh, and sometimes I'd go to these meetings and some people would cry. And when I was brand new, I didn't know what I was sitting in. When I first got to you, I didn't know that if somebody would have said, "Are you an alcoholic?" I do not know if my first meeting or my second meeting or my 10th meeting, if I would have been able to say to you and have been honest about it, yes. When I first came to you, I thought maybe I had a little problem smoking pot. That's what I thought when I first got here, because I smoked a lot of pot. If you smoke a lot of pot, you have a problem with it. Now, I drank a lot of booze, but I don't connect my problems in my life to the drinking of the booze. I drank a lot of booze. And what I found out was I also did things that would allow me to drink more. I'm going to talk a little bit about something that's probably, to me, the greatest piece of information for me that's ever happened in my life. I found out here that I am an alcoholic. I did not know what that meant when I first came to you. Because my picture, the picture that I had, maybe you had when somebody says alcoholic is, I had a picture of alcoholics. I'm bombed down in the streets of Chicago. That's where I grew up. Trench coats, living those lives, pushing those carts and carrying bottles in a sack. That was the picture I had of an alcoholic, and I didn't do that. I'm not one of them then. And what I have found out here is I don't have to live under a bridge. I don't have to push a cart. I don't have to carry a bottle in a sack to be an alcoholic. And boy, I'm grateful that I have learned that. What makes me an alcoholic is the effect that I receive when I drink it. And what I have also found out is that 90% of the people out there, 90% of the population in our country and all over the planet, 90% of the people that drink alcohol do not get the effect I get. Now, I didn't know that. Something happens to me as an alcoholic that doesn't happen to non-alcoholics. See, what I thought is if you drink too much alcohol and you get drunk, you're alcoholic. You know what? If you line up 30 people and 30 people drink a quart of vodka, you'll have 30 drunk people. There's a good chance that the percentage of those will be puking. Now, I'm a puker. Now, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. There's going to be people that are going to wake up after drinking a quart of vodka. They're going to wake up remorseful. I shouldn't have done it. Maybe during that time when they drank that quart of vodka, they said things and did things they normally wouldn't have done. That doesn't make me alcoholic. What the percentages say is of those 30 people, 3 people will have activated an illness. And sometimes that activation will cross that, what in AA we call an invisible line from controlled drinking to uncontrolled drinking, alcoholic drinking. They say out of that 33 people will cross that line at some point in their life. The other 27 will just sooner or later go, you know what, I shouldn't drink vodka like that, and they don't. They just stop. They find something, they find some inner resource that says, I can stop and I will. Now, what happened to me was that I liked the effect. Something happened to me when I drank alcohol. I didn't know that that's the beginning point for me, but when I drank alcohol, something happened that I wasn't expecting. Now, I grew up in a family of, I've got 2 older brothers, so obviously there's 3 boys in my family. My father was a professional athlete. He played in the Chicago Cubs minor league system, so athletics was a big part of our upbringing. right away I knew something was different from me because my two brothers, they were pretty good athletes. The oldest brother, a good golfer, had some other skills. The middle brother was the best athlete of the bunch. He lettered in baseball, football, and basketball during his high school years. I did none of that. I was fat, short. I didn't run fast, gravity challenged. I had all the problems. I just right away I knew something was different. Now, I was taught all the fundamentals. That's one thing my father taught me. I know how to throw a football, throw a baseball, shoot a basketball. If you elevate me on wheels or blades, I'm not very good, so I stay off that stuff. But athletics was a big part of my growing up. I went out for the football team because that's what Braves do. You go out for football. And I found out right away I had a condition that prevented me from being effective at playing football. I found out I'm a coward. I do not like getting hit, and that kind of precludes you from being very effective at the sport. When the running back's coming at you with the ball and you step aside, coach gets a little upset. And so right away I found out football wasn't me. I remember the last day of football practice, the coach came up to me and he goes, "You know, Bray, for a guy like you who showed up to every practice, every single day this entire season, you are without a doubt the worst football player I've ever seen in my life." And he was right, man. I sucked. So fat guy, short, doesn't run fast. I went to the next sport I thought I could excel at, tennis. Something amazing happened. If I could ace the serve, I did well. If they hit the ball back, that was kind of a bad deal because then I couldn't cover the court. So a lot of flops, little drops. I was bad. Then I went to a sport. It was golf. Picked up the game of golf. Golf's a good game for a guy like me. What I found out was after you hit it, you don't have to run. That's a good game for a guy like me. You don't have to jump after it. You know, you can jump if you want. You look like a fool out there, but you don't have to jump in the game of golf, so that's kind of good. Within a very short period of time, I became very good at the game and started to excel and played in some competition. Got on the high school golf team. Was in some tournaments. Actually played into my college years. Won a college golf tournament. By the time I was 17 years old, I was playing to a one handicap, and I was playing in some competitive fields where some of the guys out there, in fact, a guy I played with in college just won like $800,000. It's like he wasn't an alcoholic, that son of a gun. He drank, but he had inner resources that would allow him to stop when it was important. See, you can't practice very much when you're drunk. And one time I went out to the golf course and I did some mescaline and I can't remember some other couple other things, and I shanked my first drive out onto the driving range. And when you're looking for a white ball under about 5,000 other white balls, it gets a little confusing out there. And coach was getting a little concerned about my sanity. I remember one particular golf, because by this time I'm drinking now. I remember one particular golf tournament. I was so hungover. I had drank so much the night before, and I was shaken, and I had, I don't know the best way to call it, had nausea. And on three separate occasions during the round, I on purpose had to hit the ball into the woods. So I go in there and vomit, hit the ball back out, and try to continue. And you don't score well when you purposely hit balls into the woods. And looking for the ball, you got it. Yeah, I got it. I finished this 2-year junior college and enrolled in Northern Illinois University, and it's a town called DeKalb, and it's about 45 miles northwest of Chicago, and it's built into a cornfield. Northern Illinois is a typical college campus. It's basically buildings and bars and corn. And so I went up there and enrolled in some classes, and this was the first time on my own. I'm on my own, and I can drink like I want to drink. One of the things the book says, and this is interesting because this is one of the keys to find out if you are or if you are not alcoholic. Book says that I have some obsessive idea that there's going to be one day I can control and enjoy my drinking. And the phrase is connected, meaning I'll have to do both at the same time. Control and enjoy. Now, there were times where I enjoyed my drinking and control had nothing to do with it. When I was enjoying my drinking, it was no holds bar drinking. I got to where I wanted to get quick, and I stayed as long as I could stay. Now, if I had to control my drinking, and I didn't have to do it a lot, thank God, but if I had to control my drinking, there was no enjoying it. If somebody was watching me and monitoring, that's a good word for an alcoholic, monitoring your drinking. I don't know if you've ever had your drinking monitored. Do you know that that's your fourth one? God, shut up. Well, that's the last thing I want to know. It's my fourth one. Now, what she doesn't know is that, you know, you slip into the John and you take about eight. What you want to say under your breath, wrong. It's my 12th. God. Control and enjoy. I can't do both. I can't do them both at the same time, but I have this idea that I'm going to be able to. It also says then that I have a delusion. The thing that sets up in my head is I watch all these 90% of the population that aren't alcoholic, and they seem to be controlling their drinking. They seem to be able to do it without effort. They seem to stop. They can stop drinking and go home to Marge. And like walk the dog. They stop. Oh, I better stop now. I'm driving later. They stop. Now, I see that and I think, what's wrong with me? Because I don't want to stop. Not only do I find out I don't want to stop, I have now crossed the line from controlled to uncontrolled drinking. I want to stop and can't. When I begin to drink, I can't stop. I didn't know that what was going on, because what I started learning how to do very quickly was make excuses for my drinking. I would rationalize what I did, why I did it. I would blame you for my drinking. If I could blame you for why I drank the way I drank, and you accepted the blame, then I was home free. And you become very good at that if you're an alcoholic of my type. You find the ways to blame the people around you for your drinking. And if there's nobody to blame, by God, you just drink anyway. And you just suffer the consequences. Now, by the time I had become 20 years old, there were three. I had crossed the line from controlled to uncontrolled drinking. And when I start drinking, there's really only three endpoints. Run out, which is a bad one. Blackout, which happened almost every time I drank. Or pass out. And that's it. Those are my three endpoints when I begin to drink now. I go to this college campus. I'm supposed to be getting an education. One of the great events on a college campus is Halloween. There's some big parties at the frats. There's some big parties on campus when it's Halloween. People dress up all kind of goofy. In 1980, there was a movie that came out. It was called The Warriors, a movie about gangs. And one of the gangs in this movie was called the Baseball Furies, and these goofs painted their faces red and white and carried baseball bats and wore uniforms. And so I hung out with a bunch of other goofy guys, and we dressed up like the Baseball Furies from the movie The Warriors and went to the party. That's kind of a nice term, party. So we go to the party, and I start drinking. I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know it. I drink, and I now have lost control of my drinking, and I black out, because that's one of the things that happens to me when I start to drink. Now, the story that was told to me the following day is this. Is at some point about 2-3 o'clock in the morning, some people that I lived with in the same apartment complex saw me walking across town in a direction I shouldn't have been going. So they grab me and they take me home. And when I get into the apartment, from what the story is told, is that I had about this much of my, oh, I forgot to tell you, important part. Bats, part of our uniform, part of the mask was baseball bats. That's a good part of this story, and I forgot it. And so we're carrying baseball bats with our baseball uniforms and our red and white faces. I don't have a baseball bat, so I took out back in the 80s, they had oak closet poles. So I took out my oak 4-foot closet pole and took it to the party. So I get home about 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I have about this much left of my oak closet pole. And what I was telling my roommates was, ooh, I was hurting people. Now, I don't remember any of it. It got my attention, frightened me, because I had been prone to acts of violence. I'm not a very good fighter, but I'm got one good punch, sucker. I'm prone to acts of violence, and so, you know, this scares me. So I started looking for the next day or so about looking the college papers and the DeKalb Sentinel for descriptive verses of all the crimes taking place to see if they've got any kind of knowledge about somebody dressed up in a red and white face and a baseball uniform with an oak closet pole beating on people. And I don't find anything. So I do with that what I've done with every other bad action of my life. I discard it. And I stow it away because I don't want to think about it. By this time in my life, this is where I knew I was at. I knew what I was doing was wrong, and I couldn't stop. I knew what was going on was not the direction my life was supposed to be going, and I couldn't stop it. There were times where I would want to stop, but I couldn't. I would come up with another idea to drink. And when I start to drink, I have an obsession for alcohol. It sets up with me what our doctor's opinion of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, describes, a phenomenon of craving. If somebody would have said that to me when I was 20, I wouldn't have known what you were talking about. Looking back, I know exactly what you're talking about. When I begin to drink, I lose control of the amount that I take. I have no ability to guarantee what my actions are going to be when I start to drink. That is a characteristic of an alcoholic. I knew what I was doing was wrong and couldn't stop. I was hurting people I didn't want to hurt and couldn't stop from doing it. I was ripping the hearts out of my parents and my brothers, and I couldn't stop it. I didn't want to see the looks that I saw. I didn't want to see those eyes. I didn't want to see those glaring, disgusted, ashamed looks I was getting, and I couldn't stop it. I'm trying to get an education. Late November, I come to. Our apartment, I don't know if you can have an alcoholic apartment. Ours was close. If you went into our apartment, I'm living with three other goofy guys. I don't know if they're alcoholic, but they certainly drink a lot. And we don't clean often. Every cup, dish, plate, piece of silverware, spoon isn't in a cupboard or a drawer. It's on the countertop with various lengths of food. Some are sitting in the sink that's full of that gluppy water. We had three paper products, and they were all interchangeable at any one or given any time. We had paper towel, we had toilet paper, and we had coffee filters. And if one was gone, you used another. And it didn't matter. One could be any other one. And if you didn't have any of that, you went down to the library. Because that's the way we live. The carpet was a nice thing. It had kind of that sticky, spongy, alcoholic glistening crunch. Because so much beer and booze and every other bodily fluid was poured on it. And we're living in that. Beds aren't made. Stuff ain't clean. Kind of a nice place. So one morning, it was late November, I came to. I was actually supposed to be getting education. I came to in the living room, and my face was in that carpet. I had an intuitive thought that I have a test. An art test. I had taken art. It's my junior year. I'm in a business major. I'm taking art. Getting one of my electives out of the way. I look out the window, and the sun is shining, so I put on my uniform of the day, which happened to be, I was doing a lot of amphetamines back then, so I was about 160. So I put on my pair of shorts and my T-shirt that I had taken the sleeves off of, and it proudly proclaimed across my chest, "Free me." And on the back was nice. It had a big fist in the air. It's kind of my flag of independence. If there was one thing that described my life, that back of that T-shirt was it. That was great. And so I grabbed my number two pencil and put my thongs on and walked to class. And when I get to class, it's one of the auditorium-style seating arrangements. And when I look up to grab my seat, I notice something amazingly different from all of you as compared to me. All of you, I mean every single one of you, are in heavy winter clothing. I mean, not the light windbreaker stuff. I'm talking about the heavy stuff. I'm talking about the big overcoats and the pull-down ski masks where only eyes show, and gloves and scarves and mittens. And as I'm walking up the aisle to find a seat, a couple of people, I hear one person say, "Geez, what does that guy know that we don't?" Because you see, when I got up that morning and pulled my face from my alcoholic carpet and looked out the window, sun was shining. And this is really about the mental capacity I had when I got to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thought that came to my mind when I looked out the window and saw the sun shining was sun. Warm. Free me. That's pretty much how I got to you. I come home from that semester, and by this time my parents and my relationship is destroyed because I've lied to them, I've stolen from them, I've if you can do something to an individual because of alcoholism, I've done it. I've broken trusts. I have ripped their hearts out. Because it isn't once or twice or 10 times. It's time after time. My words are meaningless to them. Because every time I say I'm sorry, by the time I got here, they started agreeing with me. You're right, Dave, you are sorry. You're the sorriest SOB we know. So Christmas comes and goes, and between the Christmas and the New Year holiday, my parents are invited to my dad's company's holiday parties, and so the house is empty. And so this is one of those times where I thought I'd invite a couple of three or four close friends over, so I did, and that's one of those times where you invite two or three or four people over and about 98 show up. And I start drinking. Now I'm an alcoholic. I begin to drink. I can't guarantee what my actions are going to be, how much I'm going to drink. And this is a particular night where instead of blacking out, I pass out. I fall down and I lay in a corner with a heap. And now my parents' home again is laid waste by this band of nefarious thieves and thugs. And stuff is stolen and stuff is broken and the house is damaged. In my parents' bedroom, they had in their upstairs in their closet, they had their lockbox full of the house papers and deeds and wills and all that stuff. And 3 or 4 days later, my mother pulled that out from not only from their closet, but in the basement. It was jammed, dented, and beaten to within an inch of its life behind the furnace in the basement. Now, the thugs, I guess, couldn't figure out how to get in, so they just beat up the lockbox. But it's hard to describe something like that. How'd this get down there? You don't have a lie for that. There's no lie for how does that happen. Well, I got pissed at your lockbox, so I beat the crap out of it. The last thing my father said to me before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, he looked me in my eye and he said, "You know, Dave, with a son like you, I don't need any enemies." And there was absolute hatred and disgust. A man for his son. He could not stand the sight of me. Every time I told him I tried to do better, every lie I made, every promise, everything I ever tried to do because of alcoholism, I failed. What I found out that day was is I had done the gamut. And I didn't know what was about to happen, but for whatever reason, on the second day of January in 1981, as my father looked at me with a hatred that a father shouldn't look at a son with, he said, "You know what, we're tired and we don't want you living here anymore, you're gone. Is there any, you know, do you need, what do you want to do?" And words that came out of my mouth that day had never come out of my mouth. And what I said that day was, "Is if I'm going to stop drinking, I'm going to need help." And I didn't know that that sentence was the surrender that I needed to have take place before I could get what comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. I told somebody out loud that I can't handle something. I can't do it by myself. I am without power. In the first couple pages of our fourth chapter of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes a complete defeat. It describes that our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were insufficient. And then it said this: they failed utterly. And my human resources failed utterly. So they whooshed me off to a treatment center. That's a good thing. There still are out there. What I found out is that treatment center has absolutely nothing to do with my recovery. It was 28 days of non-drinking, after which they gave me my $10,000 big book. Told me to go somewhere. They were done. They had the next class coming in. So I got whooshed off to a halfway house. Kind of an interesting term, halfway house. I don't know what it's halfway to or from. Kind of a silly concept when you really think about it. 15 brand new people living all together. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. That is absolutely the stupidest thing I've ever heard. 15 brand new people with not a clue on how to be sober all gathered up in the same house thinking. And comparing notes. And resentment. Because we get them easy. I don't know about it. If you're new, I know you've got a resentment. Just you come in here, get you pissed off. So I was there for about 3 or 4 months, and probably the best thing I learned there was is I watched a guy that I got sober with. And when you're brand new, you get sober with some people. You make some fast friendships in AA. Because if you don't know this by now, most people in AA are new. The population of Alcoholics Anonymous is primarily made up of new people because that percentage of the population continues to churn. And some get sober and stay sober and keep doing action. I'm going to talk about that here in a minute. But we're new and we're comparing resentment and hatred for the old timers. Bunch of crusty old 30-year-olds. God. No wonder they stopped drinking. Their life's over, for Pete's sake. So this guy that I got sober with got drunk. And I went to save him. Get to his apartment. I knock on his door. He invites me in and he's in his recliner and he's drunk about, I don't know, 3/4 of a case of beer and cans are all crushed next to his recliner, and I don't know, he's watching Mod Squad or something. I don't know what the hell he's watching. And I said, do you want to go to a meeting? He goes, no, do you want a beer? I'm a guy that's unhappy about his sobriety. My best friend in the world. See, I don't have any friends, so this is as good as it gets right now, is this goof. My best friend in the world's drunk. AA don't work. I have just figured it out. AA don't work. You've lied to me. I said, no. I said, if you want to get sober, call me. And I decided at that time I was going to go down to Alcoholics Anonymous and resign. See, I didn't know you just stopped going. I thought you had to go down and put your notice in or something. So I went down to that meeting that night to officially quit AA. So I'm sitting in that meeting that night, pissed, trying to think about my delivery. By this time, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my language was pathetic. See, I live like alcoholics live, and my language was mostly four-letter words and colorful phrases that began with mother. And that's how I talked in your AA meetings when I first got here. I didn't realize that things were going on, that I needed to show some respect. I didn't understand what was happening here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that there's a different way to live if you want it bad enough. I thought we were all supposed to just get along. So I'm sitting in that meeting, and the guy that was leading the meeting obviously could tell I was new. And so he tried to not call on me, but he ran out of time. He ran out of people before he ran out of time, so he had to call on me. And for about the next 3 or 4 minutes, I unloaded a barrage of profanity and hatred towards Alcoholics Anonymous that should never been allowed to have been said in an AA meeting. I told you, without the profanity, I told you all what a bunch of losers you were and that this thing is a joke and it's a fraud. My buddy's drunk tonight. This thing don't work. You've lied to me. You're nothing but a bunch of mindless sheep. I can't stand the very sight of you. Oh, yeah, and I want my money back. Like I've been putting any money in the basket. And finally, the guy that was leading that meeting said something real important to me that night. He said, Dave, shut up. We're tired of listening to you. He said, Dave, I want to tell you a couple things because this may be the last time we see you. And I want you to get some information, and I want you to get some facts, and I want you to get the truth before you leave. What he told me that night was, Dave, the reason that your buddy's drunk isn't because AA doesn't work. Dave, the reason that your buddy's drunk tonight is because he chose not to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's secondary to what I really want you to understand. He said, I want you to look around this room tonight, and I want you to look in everybody's eyes before you leave, and I want you to understand there's two types of people sitting in this meeting. There's two types of alcoholics that come to AA. And maybe somebody's never told you this. He said the two types of people that sit in this meeting are there's good examples of Alcoholics Anonymous and there's bad examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now pick the one you want to be and shut up. Well, I had my first resentment in AA. How dare him talk to me like that? How dare somebody tell me the truth? See, I didn't know that there were good examples of AA and bad examples of AA. I thought we were all just loving. We all just loved each other sober. And that is a crock of crap. What has to happen for Alcoholics Anonymous to work is there has to be something to be strived for. You know, I took golf lessons when I was young. And I took golf lessons from a golf pro. This was a man who had dedicated his life to the game. He had spent years learning his craft and his trade. Maybe some people are musicians. Maybe some people are artists. Maybe some people are machinists. Maybe some people are auto mechanics. If you want to learn a trade, you go to somebody who's been doing it for years and years and years and have dedicated themselves to the techniques and the skills necessary to learn that trade. If you want to learn it well, you go to somebody who's done it well. AA isn't about stopping drinking. If somebody's told you that, they've lied to you. AA isn't about stopping drinking. Everybody here that's alcoholic knows how to stop drinking. Stopping drinking is easy. I've stopped 1,000 times. There's nothing to it. You drink too long, too much, you stop. Just that simple. What I don't know is two things. I don't know how to stay stopped. That's one. I don't know how to do that. The second thing I don't know how to do is live sober, and here's a key, and be happy about it. What I had to find was somebody who was doing it, if that's what I wanted. Now, if all I wanted was to get the heat off or to stall some court case, then I'm wasting my time and yours. But when I told my father that afternoon that if I'm going to stop drinking, I'm going to need help, what I realized was is I meant it. And what I started from that point forward was is seeking out people who were good examples of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been blessed to find some. And they've taught me what it meant to be a good example of AA. Now, if you're an alcoholic of the description of the book, and see, nobody here can claim that except me. I can't say that you're an alcoholic, but I can tell me I'm an alcoholic. And today I know without a shadow of a doubt I'm an alcoholic who once begins to drink loses all control. I'm the alcoholic of the type the book describes. I lost everything. I didn't have a heck of a lot to lose, but what I had, I lost. The thing I lost the most and the quickest was my self-respect. It was gone. I couldn't stand looking at myself. I couldn't stand looking at what I had become, knowing I'm a liar and I'm a thief, and I'm somebody who seemingly doesn't have the ability to care about the people around me because my actions certainly prove that. My intentions were great. I had the best intentions, but my actions were that of somebody who seemingly had lost control of their life. So what I have found is I had to surrender to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Within Alcoholics Anonymous, what I also found out was there were people here that were professionals. People who I could aspire to be like. Somebody had spent years learning how to be sober, again, and be happy about it. And you can tell, you can walk into an AA room and quickly determine who's happy. And you can also come into an AA room and you can quickly determine who's here under duress. They're the ones with the crinkled faces. They're the ones that have somehow come up with the idea, this doesn't work. It's not going to work for me. It can't work. My case is bigger than what you're describing. And what I found out here over a period of time, you don't find it out your first meeting, your second meeting. You got to keep coming. What I found out was is there's a set of principles here. And our book describes them as a set of principles spiritual in their nature. And you know what? If I aspire to learn these spiritual principles, they'll solve my problem. I didn't know that when I got here. Somebody described it during the session that, you know, one of the things that I found out was is I'm not going to stand in an AA meeting or sit in an AA meeting or have it in a discussion meeting or a book study and describe how godly I am. What I'm going to talk about and what I have found out here is because I aspire to be like somebody that wore Alcoholics Anonymous attractively. Their enthusiasm was contagious. Their spirit in AA was exciting to be around. They were genuinely and sincerely happy to be a sober member of AA. What a freedom. How do you get that? How is that possible? I had problems when I got here. My life sucked, and I saw no way out. I was listening to a talk on the way up here, and there's my sponsor's sponsor's talk. And he described something which I thought was really kind of a parable of AA. He was describing the very first aircraft carriers ever in the history of the war. And these airplanes that would go off these aircraft carriers, they had a flaw. They'd go into tailspins. And all these pilots would go into a tailspin, and their intuition and their training taught them to pull back on the stick. And they wouldn't come out of the tailspin, and they'd crash and burn and die. And they were losing, literally, pilot after pilot after pilot. Until one guy, by mistake, instead of pulling back on the stick, went forward. And he went out of the tailspin, and he got there. And so he came back, and he said, "This is how you get out of tailspin. You go forward." It doesn't make sense to people who think they know. No, everything says pull back. And what this guy found out was, no, push forward. What a sponsor does is he gives you an idea. Here's the action I want you to take, and your head says, that can't be right. Because my instinct says pull back, and this guy's telling me to push forward. He wants to save my life, and I'm going, no thanks, I know better. Okay, well, let's look at the history of your life. You've done it all your way, your whole life, and you're here. Nice job. Good work. I think you should continue running your life. You're doing a heck of a job. Or maybe they might say something like, you know what? It's obviously that you've run your life right into the toilet. Why don't you try doing it our way? They give me actions that don't seem to make sense. Get to the meeting on time. What the heck does that have to do with it? In fact, why don't you come early and stand out there in that goofy greeting line and shake hands with the people that are new? Uh-uh. Okay, you do it your way. We're going to watch you crash and burn later. We're going to gather the newer people that are actually trying it our way, and we're going to watch you die. Have a nice life. What we find out here is we can't help everybody because everybody doesn't want to be helped. Now that's kind of cruel. It just happens to be the facts. Most alcoholics that are going to come through your door here in Richardson, Texas, like most alcoholics that come through our door in Tulsa, Oklahoma, don't make it. Because we give them push the stick forward, and they go, that doesn't make any sense. I'm going to push it back. We suggest that you push it forward. We've had some success doing that. No thanks, I know more. Now we have this group of professional sober people, I guess that's the best way I'm going to tell you, people that have learned to live happy, sober, not drinking, and happy. You can tell it's sincere honesty and happy. You can't fake being happy about being sober. You can't fake it. You can put one of these on. You can tell. But you can also tell the people right in the middle of AA, man, because they have the gut laugh. When they share in a meeting, you can tell it's coming from their heart and that they have a sincere desire to help. Get close to those people and follow their instruction, even if it don't make sense to you. I got a sponsor, and he took me all the way through the steps. He told me to write out my fears and my resentments and my problems with sex and my problem with pride, and so I wrote all that inventory out. Best description of a fourth and fifth step I ever heard. Our life in our drinking careers, which is a nice term, drinking career. You know, we're the only people who have them. Normal people don't have drinking careers. They just drink. And when they stop, they stop. Nobody makes a career out of drinking except us. I'm thinking about issuing cards. You know, like baseball cards, you know, get your picture before and after. Put it on the back, your stats. You know. 1980. Triple crown, wrecked car, lost job, went to jail. So what I found out was that this guy described the inventory. You know, in my life, in my drinking career, I have all these bad actions. I have a lifetime of drinking and a lifetime of drinking bad actions. Those actions, I don't know if you've had these, where you wake up the next morning and you know something's wrong. You wake up with such fright, despair. You're guilty, you know it, you don't know why, you just have the sense of guilt. Because we know, we did something. You can get up and you walk through that place, your house, whoever it is, who's ever left, and they look at you. You know that look. You disgust me. We have that. So I have my life full of all those actions. And one by one throughout my drinking career, I'd come home and I didn't know what to do with that bad action, that fear, that guilt, that resentment. So I threw it out in the backyard and I closed the drapes real quick. So I get sober, and a sponsor comes over, and he pulls the blinds, and he makes this look at this backyard. It's a big pile of crap. It's my life of drinking bad actions, just a big pile of crap. The fourth step is go out in the backyard and take that big pile and make it a bunch of little piles. And in each little pile, you put a big red flag, and you label it resentment, resentment, fear, fear, sex, fear, resentment, sex, fear, resentment, sex, fear, resentment. Now you look out, instead of one big pile of a mishmash, you got a lot of little hundreds of piles and all little flags, resentment, fear, blah, blah, blah. Fifth step is finding somebody stupid enough to go out into that backyard with you while you describe every little pile. What comes of that is I have a freedom that I didn't know I could exist. I walk with a freedom. This is a man that knows how to live sober and be happy about it. He taught me. He took me through my first time where I told somebody the entire truth about my life. See, I've lived with all that shame and that remorse and that guilt. How can you not be depressed living with that garbage? And for the first time, I let somebody else have it. And he didn't excuse me. He didn't give me some phony baloney answer. He said, you know what, we're going to take some time now. We're going to make this right. We're going to take the next period of time, and I don't know how long it's going to take, Dave, but we're going to straighten it out. We're going to go to these people you've harmed, and we're going to straighten it out. And whatever amount of time it's going to take. And number one on my list was my father, because I'd ripped his heart out. And it took a long time for me to repair the damage with my father. My 15th AA birthday, my wife got sneaky, and she flew my parents in. I'm 15 years sober. And my father heard, he saw AA at its finest. And my father heard all these people get up and tell stories about his son and how much his son has helped these people and what his son meant to these people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw a little tear in my father's eye. And that Sunday when we went back to the airport, my father pulled me aside. And he said, you know, Dave, there was a time where I thought maybe you had a promising golf career. He said, but after this weekend, it's obvious that you've been called to a higher order. And now every single time I talk with my father, our conversation ends with, Dad, I love you. And he tells me, Dave, I love you. And I didn't think that could ever happen again. My oldest brother, alcoholic. One time during our talks in the kitchen with my parents, I found out I thought I was the only alcoholic. It seemed like nobody else had this problem. I was just the black sheep. And what I found out is both sides of my parents' family are just blooming alcoholic. No wonder, God, I didn't have a chance. My mom's an alcoholic. Watching her die of the disease of alcohol is the hardest thing I've ever seen. Alcoholism is rough on everybody. It seems to be a little bit rougher on women. And alcoholism just takes its toll on women. And I watched my mom just whittle away to nothing. She had, at the end, she had cirrhosis of the liver, and it was just horrendous. And my wife and I almost never fought, but when we'd fight is when I'd have to go make my living amends and we'd go visit my parents. And I couldn't stand looking at my mom die of the disease. And through a series of circumstances, my father lost his job, so he was at home. And one night about 2 o'clock in the morning, he wakes up and my mom's not in the bed, so he goes looking through the house and he finds her in the kitchen and she's chugging down a bottle of vodka, good alcoholic as she is. My father called me the next day and he said, what do we do? And on the 8th day of January of 1993, we stuck my mom in a treatment center. Because what do? You whoosh them off to a treatment center. And on the 8th day of January in 1994, I got to stand up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Sarasota, Florida. I got to hand my mom her one-year sober medallion. And on the 8th day of January in 1998, I got to stand up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I got to hand my mom her five-year sober medallion. And last January in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, My mother stood up, and I handed her a 10-year sober medallion. And in that meeting, my father stood up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he thanked Alcoholics Anonymous for his wife and his mother and his son back. The spiritual set of principles here saved that man's wife and saved that man's son. And now it saved his second son, because my brother just celebrated a year of sobriety 3 days ago. Now, I'm known to be a guy who kind of is a little bit adamant about AA. I'm a guy now who tells people to shut up, sit down, get ready to work some steps, if you want to get well, we're going to do the things the right way here. We're not going to do them yours. People are a little offended by my sincerity. The one thing that I do know is this, is the program and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the family members of alcoholics, the power in an Al-Anon meeting save lives. But it is only true if. There are conditional statements in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I must come forward to you with some effort if these things are going to work. What our book says is it's a way of life which demands, that's not an easy word for an alcoholic of my type. Demand is like fight. Nobody's going to demand nothing from me because nobody's going to tell me what to do. But our book says we demand something. It's a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. If you want to be well, you're going to have to get honest about your faults and our failings and our bad decisions and our bad choices. If I can get that poison out, I have a chance to fill it in with something new, and it's a spirit that somehow sits here in AA. What I found out, because I had a good teacher in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I found out was the most spiritual act that takes place here. You know, our program, Alcoholics Anonymous, started on the 10th day of June in 1935. The man who got sober first in Alcoholics Anonymous got sober in December 1934. He was 6 months sober, and yet AA's birthday isn't that day. AA's birthday is the day that one alcoholic helped another alcoholic achieve permanent sobriety. And that's the 10th day of June in 1935, and that's when Bill 12-stepped Dr. Bob successfully. And Bill never had another drink, and Bob had another drink. And what the book says is these two men set out frantically upon the new alcoholics arriving in that town's hospital. Or the Akron City Ward, excuse me. And what I found out was that my sponsor did the exact same thing to me. He carried the message of hope that's here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he carried it to me. And that's what happens here. It happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. It also happens in the program of Al-Anon. We carry a message of hope. If you're tired of living the way you're living right now, there's a different way to live if you want it bad enough. If you're happy with what you got, take it. Keep it away from me. But don't bring yours into my meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because I won't allow it. There's a message of AA here, and it's recovery, and it's our 12 steps, and it's sponsorship, and it's helping one alcoholic with another alcoholic. What I have found out is that when I reach my hand out and have a sincere desire to help another member of AA without any reward for me, just trying to pay back the guy that brought me the message, I get something. I get a feeling of well-being. What I found out was I was swallowing alcohol to get it, and I never got it. There's a feeling of well-being that happens when I help one other person. And what I find is I want more of it. Every day is a day when I get up, I thank God for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that today I have a relationship with the God of my understanding, and for that I'll always be grateful. Thanks for allowing me to participate.
Before we begin participation, I'd like to thank our speaker, Dave B., for coming out to speak for us tonight. And I'll do him a favor and get it over with early and call on Steve.
Hi, my name is Steve Dine, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
Sobriety date, August 24, 2001, and wow. What a good day to be sober. Thanks, Dave, for coming out and speaking for us, and it's just been awesome. This last few weeks has just been neat at the group. On Thursday nights, we've had such a great turnout, and it's just a testament to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and just how it can change people's lives. I guess thinking back to this last week on Tuesday, I got a lot of gratitude. I went to another meeting at a group where there was a discussion meeting, and it just, you know, it wasn't anything like our group, and I just wished for the enthusiasm and that lacked there, and I was just thinking how much better it can be, you know, and I feel like I've been very blessed coming into this group, because for me it was really a God deal. I just kind of happened upon it, and then I saw something here, and I finally got desperate enough to start following directions, and And with that, I've my life has gotten a lot better. Thanks.
How about Tim?
Thanks. I'm Tim Moore. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since June 14th, 1994. Thankful for that. Dave, looking forward to hearing your story. Thanks a lot for coming down. And it's great to see all the Minnesota guys and everybody down from Tulsa. You know, that's the thing I was kind of reflecting on the way over is something that talks about in our book about how we're going to make lifelong friends here. You know, that we're going to band in with these alcoholics and make lifelong friends. And I was thinking about just the people that I've known over the years and the experiences I've had at my home group and then the type of weekends like we're going to have this weekend, a big book study. And it gets me excited to get to come to my home group and sit in a meeting. I was trying to convey that to a newcomer before I came out. And he said something that I've thought many times. You know, I'm not feeling too well. I just need to kind of stay home, take care of myself, and get over this thing. And I know that if he's an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, this is what I need to feel better. You know, this is what I need is to get in the middle of this place and to be a part of this deal. So I'm thankful to be here and excited about the rest of our meeting. Thank you.
Over here from Teresa. She's hiding in the back there.
I'll kill you later. I'm an alcoholic and my name's Teresa.
Hi, Teresa.
My sobriety date's June 21st, 1987, and for that I'm truly grateful. And I really don't know what to say. I'm really glad that I landed here. I've only been here a couple of weeks. What I've learned over the years is if there's too much resistance, it's probably not God's will. You know, if I keep hitting the wall, and I haven't hit any walls since I got here, and I'm grateful for that because it was a major decision to come up here. But like I said, I am happy to be here, and I'm as grateful as I know how to be sober. And that's about all I have. Thanks.
How about Byron? I'm Byron Loss, alcoholic. Sober since November 11th, 93 for that period of time. I'm very grateful. And it's good to be in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dave, looking forward to hear you talk. And, you know, I rode up here with my sponsor. And, you know, it's always good to spend some quality time with your sponsor because I had to get honest about some things, you know. And that for the type of alcoholic that I am, you know, I got to do those things. And, and I get to have the grace of God and stay sober another day. And, you know, I don't know. You know, our group, last night, you know, we wrapped up chapter 3, more about alcoholism, and started in We're Gnostics. And the thing that sticks out in my head today is that tonight is that I'm a hopeless alcoholic. You know, this weekend we're gonna get together, 40-something guys gonna get together in Mike and Karen's house. And I want to thank Karen and Mike for opening up their house. And we gather together, and the Real Gnostics talks about, you know, for me, about that time, first time I ever read that big book and actually meant it. And I got something out of it through the desperation and the hopelessness of my condition. Step 2, that power. And, you know, we're going to meet together this weekend, 40-something guys. And there's going to be a lot of things going on there. And when I first got here, if you'd have told me that my first big book study I went to, there was about like 20-something guys there. And my sponsor said, yeah, you going. So I went to the big book study, and I'm like, man, I ain't never been introduced to anything like that. You know, the weekend at the lake with some guys? Come on. This can't be the answer. I got problems, man. I'm living in Woody's Wino House. I got a minimum wage job, and I got back child support. That cannot be the answer.
and through God, through the sponsorship, home group, and staying active in AA and finding myself in that big book that was the answer, is to surround myself around you guys and to get rid of this thinking up here. You know, that's it. Get rid of this thing up here. This thing here will kill me. It will kill me because I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here.
I'd like to hear from Ernie.
Ernie!
I'm Ernie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ernie.
My sobriety date is December 18th of 98. I guess the big thing here is that I'm really excited about coming down here. It's interesting to see new faces and, you know, get to learn a few things and talk to guys that I talk to on the phone and don't even know their names, you know. But I am just willing to do a lot of things that I never was before. And I'm really grateful for AA and for meeting you, Mike. It's I'm really looking forward to it, to read out of the big book and get to learn some stuff about myself and whatever. So it's going to be fun. Thanks.
How about Chris?
Chris!
You're not asleep then, baby. My name's Chris Hatfield. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris!
And sobriety date's February 10th, 2003, and I'm as grateful as I know how to be. And it's good to see sensitive here. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's everything you need. And if you're an alcoholic and you're wanting to fight some, it'll be everything you don't need. And that's exactly how it is for me. Just like he was saying a while ago, if you want an excuse, you can get an excuse, and you don't have to show up. You can go off, and you can sit in that corner, you can be miserable, or you can end up like me, sitting in a closet with a shotgun. My first sobriety date was December 8th, 91. Until 96, I worked the program as best as I could. And then until I called Mike February 10th, it was pretty well my program. And without a God of your understanding, without a building of a spiritual basis, you're going to end up with a little Satan like me. That's what my wife said. You're just like the devil. You need to go away. Today I can look at things in a whole different perspective. I think it was 3 weeks ago. I had a cousin or a nephew that got killed from alcoholism, and the things that happened to him, the way he got killed, in my family, we were raised an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and in my mind is go take care of the situation and do it. But through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, having a sponsor and someone to talk to before you go do what you think you're going to do and find out there is a different way. And that's how I work it. And like you said a while ago, you can come up with an excuse. I got a message before I got home. Right before I got home, the phone was ringing. I didn't have time to get to it, so my wife went there, got the message. An uncle of mine had a heart attack, and we're fixing to open heart surgery, so there's my little excuse to get out of here. And I could have. But like my dad said, God is a gentle person. And even as bad as I was, a lot of you don't know, and if you did, you'd probably leave. He'll even forgive a person like me. And that's where I'm at.
But Scott.
My name is Scott Kelvin, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Scott.
My sobriety date is 10/21 of 01, and for that I am truly grateful. The buildup for this weekend has been going on for about 3 weeks. My job for this weekend is to bring pork, and that's been a good thing. And, you know, it's just a great thing to have something to do and to be able to be a part of something like this. I take that very seriously, and I enjoy it every second of it. And I'm just glad that I can be a part of this deal. I really am. And thanks you guys for coming down, Dave, and for Mike for having this, and Karen for your generosity in your home. So thank you very much.
About Ben.
Benny!
Hi, I'm Ben Hooter, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ben!
And my sobriety date is August 12, 2002, and what fun. I'm really looking forward to this weekend. I've had, my week has been, you know, pretty mellow. I did have an interview this week, and without this program, I would never have gotten to that point. You know, I had when I got out of Cornell and came into action, kind of had like these three goals, and that was to get a car, get a an apartment, you know, be financially stable, and to work towards this position. And because of this program, I've been able to get the car, get the apartment. You know, and work hard and be of service to my job, and I got to do this interview, and it's kind of the third part of this that you know I wanted to achieve, and the book study couldn't come at a better time because I'm pending right now, and I'll find out on Monday what happens, and so I just can't wait to get my mind off of it and you know get busy and get down to work and feel the way I did when I got out of Dave's book study. You know, because I had a spring in my step, you know, after that, and a lot more enthusiasm than I did before, than I ever had about the program. And I look forward to that, and we'll see y'all tomorrow.
Doug.
Dougie!
My name's Doug Gibbs. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Doug.
Been sober since December 27th of 1999. Dave, I'm looking forward to your talk. You know, I can relate to having something to do. I was so excited yesterday when I got to go treat the yard. You know, and I've got the illegal stuff that I use at Mike's, and you know, got the propionyl butoxide, mixed it in there with the 50W, and I'm just, oh, this is gonna be so much fun. And you know, it's something to do. You know, and it's something I'm good at for once. And, yeah, I was with Steve when we were at that meeting, and my God, I've heard it said before, people in Alcoholics Anonymous dying for Alcoholics Anonymous right there in front of our faces. I'm glad Steve was between me and the guy in the back saying, I don't understand what you people are talking about. I so disagree with putting the program before all of these problems. You know, I owe money. I do this. I do that. I just want to throw an ashtray at this guy and tell him to, no, listen to us, man. And, you know, we're in this room full of people, and the two people that talk about sponsorship are the two people that were the guests. You know, and this weekend is about sponsorship. And it just reaffirms that that I'm where I want to be. And, you know, the guys from Cornell that call me sponsor, I want you to pay attention tonight because you're going to get a great, great view of what you're going to have the opportunity to decide when you get out, you know. Do I go this way or do I go that way? Well, pay attention. Meet some of the guys because you're going to get a great view of what it is. And thanks for calling me.
Danny.
Danny. I'm Danny Kroll, alcoholic.
Hi, Danny.
I've been sober since April 24th of 94. Dave, I'm looking forward to hearing you talk. Thank you for coming down tonight. And welcome to the guys from... other guys from Tulsa and guys from Minnesota. You know, this has been a really good week. I've been, you know, looking forward to the book study all weekend, or not all weekend, but all week. It started off last Thursday when Rita came down and gave us a great talk, and then Saturday going to the Shawnee Fellowship Group to help celebrate their anniversary. And I had a chance to make an amends this week that, you know, something I had just forgotten about when I'm in my first list. And I was having lunch with a guy that I went to high school with a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about, you know, this incident of vandalism that I participated in. I just destroyed other people's property when I was younger. And I knew I needed to, you know, talk to Mike about that, and got instruction on how to handle that. And was kind of afraid of, you know, what the price tag on it was going to be. And, you know, was able to, you know, take care of that and, you know, sleep with a clear conscience. And anyway, I'm glad to be here and looking forward to the rest of the meeting.
Okay, she didn't get away. Ann?
Hi, my name is Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ann.
Sobriety date's January 23rd, 2002. And I'm glad to hear you speak. Doug has been on fire for at least 2 weeks about this. I thought he was going to wet himself. He is so excited about this big book study. And I'm really glad because he's just not with it these days. So that'll be good to be around you guys. You know, this week I was able to go to a sponsor-type meeting with some of the girls in our sponsorship line. And we were talking about the 10th step with it being the 10th month. And something that I just don't even think about is that the 10th step does talk about walking into the world of the Spirit. And it's not just, you know, taking the inventory, but it's also about inviting God into our lives to help us look at the underlying things that are going on, and to actually give us the direction to turn the defects into assets. And that's a blessing for me, because it's one of those things where I've always carried my defects around like this scar, and what you should be looking at me is all these negative debits, and it never once occurred to me that it could be a benefit to somebody else to see that I've done it too, and it's not such a bad deal. So that's where I'm at this week, is entering the world of the Spirit. Glad to be here. Good to be sober.
Mike.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike Erickson, alcoholic. Hi. July 19th, 87 is my sobriety date. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for coming, Dave. I always look forward to Dave's talk. Glad to see all you guys down here. Guys, you know, I'd say what a great deal to drive from Minnesota all the way down, but I've done it. You know, I mean, I've done that kind of stuff. We've all, those of us that stay here do that kind of stuff. That's what we do. I mean, that's what we do. We get in the car and we go. Why? I don't want to miss it. I don't want to miss it. I like what Ernie talked about is, suddenly, see, I live my life. I'm an alcoholic. I live my life selfish and self-centered. I take from people and I use people and I tear them up and I throw them away. And I do what I want to do when I want to do it. And that recipe of living got me to the point where I was, where my own self-imposed crisis got me to a point where I couldn't live the way I was living anymore. And our book talks about a spiritual life or an alcoholic death. They're not easy alternatives to face. And I certainly found myself in that case. Follow you or just end it. Because I promise you, neither one looked attractive to me. Neither one looked like it was a really good deal or a real way out. You know, how does this stuff, go to this weekend, you talked about it. How does this have anything to do with what I need to do to get out of this mess I'm in? How does that have anything? But you know what? I got to that point where I was defeated. The way I lived my life was what defeated me. It wasn't alcohol and all that other stuff I did. The way I lived my life defeated me. And I finally got to this point where, and I don't know why it was, why I sat in your meetings for a year and a half and didn't do anything you suggested. And I got miserable. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't make regular meetings. I didn't do anything. I just did what I wanted to do. I was, you know, sober up a horse thief. What do you got? Sober horse thief. That's what I was. And I understand that phrase today. After a year and a half, for some reason, that moment of desperation kicked in where I said, I can't keep, I'm stone cold sober and I can't keep living the way I'm living. I got to get some kind of help. I got to get some kind of help. And for some reason, one day, I'm not willing, and the next day, I'm in that shape where you set the terms and conditions. You set them. And I'll go that way. And I don't know why one day was different from the next. I guess it's just a level of desperation that caused me to be at a point where I would do anything you asked me to stay sober. And thank God I hit that point. And thank God I'm at that point, because I suffer from a deadly disease, which means that I don't get the privilege of living like Buck and Cindy, you know, across the street, who are making macaroni salad and playing Parcheesi tonight and drinking a bottle of white wine, which they'll put the cork back into tonight. You know, I don't get the privilege to live like that. But then again, I look at the privilege I get of sitting with you. Why would I want to miss this? I'm like you. You know, the deal is when I, the reason I knew I was desperate that day is because I suddenly found myself trying to become like you rather than finding ways to be different than you. I finally found myself trying to be just one of the crowd rather than a standout or a holdout. And thank God I hit that level. I'm glad to be here and glad you guys are here. Thanks.